Good morning. This is John Richardson speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. Today is Monday, January the 31st, 2022, at roughly 8:30 in the morning for me, which means that it's my weekly chat with Jimmy Sexton of the Esquire Group, where we continue working our way through that great book, Charles Adams, For Good and Evil: The History of Taxation and Civilization. So, how are you today, Jimmy?
I'm doing fantastic, John. How are you?
I am fine. And today is, I think, an incredibly important lesson. And it's amazing that this book was written in 1992. It is almost as though Mr. Adams foresaw the Obama administration.
He's like the Nostradamus of tax.
Exactly.
But no, I think this is such an important lesson. And I think illustrates very well where we're really at today.
Well, let me read this out, because for people who listen to this, I think they will instantly relate to this and instantly know where the discussion is going. And by the way, before I read this, I have a simple question for you, Jimmy. Would you or could you confirm that you believe in liberty?
I absolutely do.
I thought so. All right. Well, then reading on here, here is lesson 11. If liberty is to be defended with success against the dominance of the state, then financial privacy must be preserved. Banking privacy is one of the cornerstones of liberty, having its roots in the principle of early English law that a man's castle, parentheses, primarily his treasury, is beyond the surveillance of the king. Oh my God, I think I better read that a second time.
Oh, how far we have veered from liberty.
That's why I better read it again, okay? So here we go. If liberty is to be defended with success against the dominance of the state, then financial privacy must be preserved. Banking privacy is one of the cornerstones of liberty, having its roots in the principle of early English law that a man's castle, primarily his treasury, is beyond the surveillance of the king. Whoa. So, would you say there's a relationship between financial privacy and liberty?
100%. I think, you know, I mean, absolutely, right? Because I mean, if you don't have financial, you know, I think when it comes to governments, when it's kind of like, it's like asking someone, well, how much do I need to pay? And how much you got, right? I mean, that's really the state will take as much as they can of what you have. And if they know how much you have, they're going to try to find a way to take it. And the only way to really protect yourself is financial privacy.
So don't you think that it's time for a short form tax return, something like line one, how much did you make? Line two, send it in.
Listen, absolutely. I mean, like we said on our last podcast, I mean, I think a state needs tax to survive. But look, if the tax rate were 5 to 10%, people wouldn't be trying to evade it. I think they'd happily pay it for what they're getting from the state, for the protection, for the opportunity to do business. But where we've gotten to now is just extortion. I mean, it's a confiscation.
Well, not only is it a confiscation, but it's the kind of confiscation where the person who's this object of the confiscation, namely the taxpayer, has to pay all kinds of additional compliance and complexity costs just for the privilege of being subject to the confiscation, right?
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, this is exactly what FATCA and CRS and all this automatic exchange of information is all about, right? It has nothing to do with stopping tax evasion. I mean, I'm sure it has some effect on that, but the majority of it is just, which goes back to a previous lesson, is to survey wealth so it can be taxed. That's the core reason of it.
Well, and bear in mind, you know, you talk about exchange of information, you know, people like Mr. F-Bar and Uncle Fatka, there's no exchange going on there at all. That's just, you know, sucking up the information, sucking it up. And of course, you know, as you and I both know, once you get beyond a simple bank or brokerage account, Mr. F-Bar is not all that easy to figure out sometimes, right?
That is a very, very good point, and one that is so often missed by so many Americans abroad, right? I mean, it's really, if all you have is a bank account or a brokerage account, it's pretty simple, right? But when you start getting into issues of, you know, like a security deposit on your apartment that you rent, and some of the more complex financial products out there and stuff, it gets pretty tricky.
I think it can get very, very tricky. And since we're briefly taking a foray into the workings, the inner workings of Mr. F-Bar, I was reading the regs on the weekend, so I think maybe I'll ask you this.
Sounds like a thrilling weekend, John.
Oh God, you have no idea. It did, however, put me to sleep early on the couch. So, but
that's good.
The thing is, I did find something that caught my eye that I thought was interesting. So here's the scenario. So as you know, there's still enough liberty in Canada so that Canadian residents buy houses. Make a note of it, okay?
Wait, Canadian residents can buy houses?
Yeah, they actually buy houses.
Okay, well, that's unique.
So that's the starting point in the story, okay? So when they buy a house, typically, especially in a crazy housing market like they have here, the more repressive Canada gets, the more the real estate prices go up, by the way. You know, so they would give, for example, you know, $1 million house, they might give a $200,000 deposit. Okay?
Yeah.
Now, that $200,000, okay, generally the deposit goes to one of two places. The real estate agents will, of course, pressure you to put it in their real estate trust account because that protects their commission, right? You know, the ones who don't trust their real estate agents and trust their lawyers slightly more than they trust the real estate agent, okay, would argue that, no, you know what, I'll put it in my lawyer's trust account. It's there, okay, I'll put it in my lawyer's trust account. Okay, so here's the situation. Now, to add to the plot thickens. Not only do Canadian residents buy houses, but some of those have U.S. citizenship. Okay. So let's say we have a U.S. citizen who's a Canadian resident who buys a house and puts a $200,000 deposit, which goes either into a lawyer's trust account or a real estate brokerage trust account. Does that need to be reported on an FBAR?
Yeah, it's financial interest in the account.
All right. Now, part two, I agree with you. Now, of course, the way the FBAR rules are written, okay, you have to report, you know, where the account is, who owns the account, and the highest balance in the account. So my question for you, Jimmy, is technically, shouldn't that U.S. citizen knock on the door of that lawyer and say, I need to know the balance in your trust account?
Yes.
I think so, too. So smart lawyers in Canada, you know, the moment that somebody comes in and says, I bought a house and I want to put the deposit in your trust account, the first question that lawyer should ask is what?
You American or green card holder or otherwise a U.S. person?
That's right. And let's say the person says, well, yeah, but why are you asking me that? Then your answer becomes,
I don't want to do business with you.
Or because I'm going to have to open a separate trust account for you and you only. And I'll have to consult Jimmy Sexton to determine how much to charge you.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, my fee's up to $12 million now. So, I mean, it's an expensive commission.
No, this is really interesting, isn't it? You know, as I was reading that, I mean, it just shows you you know, not only how intrusive this is, but how it clearly intrudes, right? You know, on other people around them. But anyway, okay, so you agree with me. You know, I was thinking about this and thought, no, that's completely over the top. But I agree.
That's absolutely right.
All right, so there needs to be some sort of a special counseling for Americans. Either don't buy a house or, you know, maybe it should become a legal specialty dealing with Americans.
Yep.
Okay, so that's a bit of FBAR trivia. All right, so we go back to this, you know, this whole thing with financial privacy now. And I want to tell you about an experience I had. I think it was in November. By the way, these are not really the most exciting moments of my life, but they are sometimes the most memorable.
Okay.
And although very unexciting, this is a very memorable moment where I was watching a presentation from inside the United States, looking out at the world. And, you know, the question was, well, how do people inside the United States, tax people, right, or Treasury, how do they actually see the world? So there was a slide up, and there were three intersecting circles, okay? The first was 1040, okay, namely, how much tax do you owe, right? The second circle was information returns, 5471, 3520, all this good stuff. And the third was FBAR. So it seems to me that the notion of taxation, tax compliance, is clearly mostly understood now to be the extraction of information under threat of penalty. Would you agree?
100%.
I mean, that's an amazing thing. So you have all these poor Americans abroad running around, you know, and they're thinking, like, what's going on? I don't owe any tax. I mean, would you say that they're misconstruing the purpose of the tax system?
Well, I think it depends on how you look at it, right? I mean, I think if you're the state, the purpose of the tax system is to extract as much money as you can from people as possible. And so I would say, if you're looking at this from the government standpoint, this is exactly what the tax code is supposed to do, right? I mean, and not just in the US, but worldwide. I mean, you look at FATCA, you look at CRS, I mean, even you look at all of these ridiculous money laundering laws that they've made, it all exists for one purpose, and that is to survey wealth, to gain information, to find out where that wealth is so that it can later be taxed, right? They're not, I mean, the end game here is not surveying it to force people into compliance now. I mean, the end game here is how much money is out there so we can tax it, right? And if you don't pay your taxes, well, then we're going to take your passport. We're going to put you in jail. We're going to, you know, hit you with all these penalties you've mentioned. So I think from a citizen standpoint, a taxpayer standpoint, yeah, it's a gross misuse of the tax system, and that's how it was intended. But I think from the government standpoint, it's doing exactly what they want it to do.
Yeah. So, you know, I listen to all these CPAs who I've listened to speak with in my life, right? And here's a phrase that I've heard so many times. I'd like you to comment on this. They say, this is only an information return. There is no tax owing. Now, do you think, Jimmy, that makes it safe?
Well, no, because there's a huge penalty risk, right? I mean, and look, if we talk specifically about the United States, if you forget one of these information returns, the statute of limitations stays open forever on your tax return, on the whole tax return.
Yeah.
Not just the part related to that international information return. And the penalties are astronomical, right? I mean, the penalties are a whole nother revenue stream over and above tax.
I mean, but as you mentioned that, of course, the penalties are a revenue stream and they are recognized as such, and they often come in as revenue offset provisions. But are you aware, I mean, probably you are, but maybe not, because this is not, you know, something that's talked about all that much. But you're aware that FR penalties are now indexed to inflation?
No, I did not know that.
Well, okay. They are. They have been. They have been for some years.
Yeah, so, but the $10,000 filing threshold has not been invested.
Exactly. So what's happening here is that as inflation brings more and more people into the penalty net, the increase in the penalties means they get more penalties. Agreed? I mean, from an investment point of view, don't you think that's absolutely ingenious?
Oh, for sure. I mean, it's ingenious. I mean, the whole tax system, the way they have it set up, right? I mean, when you look at the, you know, I kind of look at tax returns the way I looked at, you know, a lot of times when you take tests, they try to fail you, right? You have all the trick questions that were, you know, where they try you, they hope that you get it wrong so you fail the test. And I think the tax system's rigged the same way, right? They want you to fail because you're going to hit penalties.
Well, it's very, you know, I mean, I think another way of viewing it is this, that, you know, most everybody at some time has sat through a presentation explaining leverage in real estate. You know, you put down this amount and, you know, the value goes up, you know, while you're just paying off the mortgage. I mean, that's really the principle behind, you know, indexing FR penalties to inflation, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, it's easy to see this as sort of investment grade stuff.
No, for sure. I mean, look, I've always had this view of, like, every U.S., especially with the citizenship-based taxation, that every U.S. taxpayer is like a little savings account for the government, right? Like, they're running around paying taxes, and, you know, if the government needs more money, they just press them a little bit. Almost for sure they did something wrong, right, by accident. And now they owe penalties, and they can't afford to hire somebody, so they just pay the penalties. I mean, it's kind of like a, you know, it's like the mafia. You know, you need money, just charge a little bit more for your protection money.
Oh, come on. I mean, isn't there more morality in organized crime than there is in government?
I would say probably so.
Yeah. You know, I mean, there's this great scene at the end of, I think it was the first Godfather movie, where, you know, the heads of all the crime families in New York are sitting around a table, and, you know,
like the G8 or the G7.
Yeah, something like that. Exactly. Yeah. Something like that. And then one of them says, you know, sort of in the conversation, and says, oh, come on. I mean, what do you think we are, lawyers? We're reasonable people, right?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, the same principle. What do you think we are, government people? I mean, we're reasonable people.
So let me ask you this question, John, thinking about today's lesson. So where would one go to find liberty today? Where can one go? What can one do to try to find liberty? And are countries that don't charge income taxes, do they provide more liberty than those that do?
Well, those are, you know, two or three separate questions. And I'll take a stab at the first one. You know, where would you go? I think that, you know, clearly you stay away from the first world democracies that have now been existing long enough so that, you know, more people vote for a living than work for a living. My instinct is that you go to the, you know, the European countries that are recovering from years under the Iron Curtain. I don't know, sometime in the last 10 years, I took a train from Slovenia to Serbia, Belgrade, Serbia. I gotta tell you, I don't think I've ever felt as free in my life as I did, you know, for that that short period of time. I mean, it was clear there wasn't a lot of regulation, you know, and things just kind of worked. You know, you could get on a train. It wasn't that complicated to get a ticket, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And that was my thought at the time, you know, that basically, you know, these people are, they're in growth mode, they're in recovery mode. They still have an institutional memory of what it means to not have liberty, et cetera. So probably there, or actually, you know, I once flew into Belgrade and I, for some reason I got in it, you know, late one in the morning or something like that. Walked outside and, you know, all the shuttle buses into the city were finished, right? That was it. And so the driver of the shuttle bus, I'm not kidding, okay? You know, one of the commercial shows, so sure, I'll take you down, no problem. You know, I, you know, obviously paid him for it. But I mean, that would never happen in North America just because of the regulations. Or I remember once, you know, these are fleeting memories, my Liberty memories. I remember Dublin Airport, flying back from Dublin once. And, you know, there's all these buses and everything, but there's also a lot of electrical lines, you know, with for lighting and stuff like that. And one of the electrical lines wasn't working. And there were two or three guys who were fixing it, right? And they were just sort of there. You know, it was clear that it wasn't a big elaborate thing, you know, 5,000 people do the work of one person. And, you know, and it was clear that one of them was having a bit of trouble holding himself up. And the other one was just, you know, providing the cover, you know, here, put your feet on my hands. You know, you would never see this in North America. Never.
It's interesting that you say that. I wrote an article very much at the beginning of COVID. I'm trying to remember what it was called. I think it was called Where Will Liberty or Where Will Freedom Exist in the Future? And it was right as all of these rules and regulations were coming down around COVID with all these COVID passports and tracking and all this kind of stuff. And I remember thinking to myself, this is like 9/11 all over again, right? Like they're trying to convince everybody to give up their liberty for fear of this really scary virus. And you know, a lot of people did. And I really had the thought to myself then, I said, you know, the only place you're really gonna be able to find liberty in the future are developing countries, because they don't have the financial wherewithal to deal with all of this tracking and surveillance and all this stuff. Like you said, they're still trying to deal with building, with recovering, mm-hmm. and they have more important things to worry about. And there's still freedom to be found there.
Yeah, and they don't, you know, they haven't, you know, sort of, you know, militarized the police, you know, also, at least not to the extent that they have in my part of the world, which I would say generally be Canada and the United States.
Yeah.
But I think that's right. I think that's right. And I think we're seeing more of a, you know, more of an awareness of that. I mean, I think that there are people who are attracted to these places because of a greater sense of freedom. But I also think there's people attracted to them because, you know, they cost less to live in. Because they don't have the expensive overhead, you know, that these first world democracies have. Like I remember reading in Toronto once, you know, back to the cost of democracy and the regulation. So Toronto has a very well-developed ravine system, and it's really a great thing. Everybody who doesn't live in Toronto knows about it. People in Toronto, of course, have no idea it exists, which is generally true of anywhere. So there was a set of stairs basically going down into the ravine, sort of from the street, right? And these entrances to the ravines are often in residential neighborhoods. So some guy who happened to be a carpenter and lived in the neighborhood decided to fix the stairs. So he converted, you know, what was really a dangerous situation, you know, particularly in winter, you know, to a first rate, you know, professionally perfectly built set of stairs. Well,
oh no.
What do you think the city of Toronto thought of this?
Oh, I think they were pissed.
Yeah, not only that, not only do they go after him, but then to prove their righteousness, you know, I mean, I can't remember what
the 20 stairs down
or 25 stairs. They then went out and rebuilt themselves at the cost of, you know, something like 50,000 plus.
Oh my God. It's just moronic, right?
Well, it really is. It really is. I mean, it's operating on a couple of different levels, right? One is just the sheer stupidity. I mean, they should have given the guy the key to the city for the day or the week or something, right? You know. But the second is, it's as though only government can provide, you know, services, right?
Yeah.
And anything that's not a government-provided service, notwithstanding the fact that it's bloated and probably not the best you can get, you know, probably like buying a Chevrolet, you know, it sort of does the job, you know, but it's not never going to be, you know, the top of the line. Agreed?
100%.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Governments are the Chevrolets of quality, you know, or something of that nature. But this is, I think, another reason why you get all these people who are getting ready to think about their retirements and why all of a sudden they start thinking about these other places just because they cost less to live in.
Yeah.
It's expensive to live in North America.
And you know what one of the other things is, and I mean, this is, I don't mean to pick on my country of origin, but at least as a citizen of most other countries, right? Most other first world countries, you have the option to go seek liberty somewhere else because they don't have citizenship-based taxation. Mm-hmm. But in the United States with the citizenship-based taxation, if you only have a U.S. passport, I mean, you're really kind of precluded from going and finding liberty and freedom and things like that until you're able to shed that passport. I mean, it's
that's right. U.S. citizenship, unfortunately, is probably a guarantee that you're less free than citizens of many other countries. In fact, most other countries at this point, that's the interesting thing about it. So, you know, James Dale Davidson wrote this extremely prescient book in the mid-90s, The Sovereign Individual. And he was talking about this. You know, where he says that, well, in the industrial age last century, U.S. citizenship was a great thing, presumably just because, you know, there were plenty of jobs and industry and stuff like that. But the 21st century, he said, the digital age, because of citizenship taxation, is going to be the worst thing you could have. And, yeah. You know, he is absolutely right. So, you know, given that background, do you imagine that that would be any reason for U.S. Congress to get rid of citizenship taxation?
There's no chance of getting rid of citizenship-based taxation. I mean, you know, I know there's all these expat groups and all this stuff that continue to push for it, and I think it's really a fruitless endeavor because, one, it gives the United States access to a huge amount of financial data worldwide. I mean, not just in the form of FBARs and the FATCA filings, but in the form of, I mean, if you think about like a 5471, right? I mean, if I'm partners in a foreign corporation, when I buy that foreign, buy 10% or more of it, even if it's not a CFC, I got to provide all the information, right? It's financials, where it's registered offices, where its books and records are kept, all of this stuff, right? And I have to report its value on my 8938 if I'm over the threshold every year, if I'm not filing the 5471. I mean, the U.S. has an enormous financial information gathering apparatus that is hugely valuable to it.
And hugely dependent on citizenship taxation.
Exactly.
Now, I really like what you're saying, because this is something that I have been saying for years. You know, people think I'm kidding or they think I'm making this up. So you are my witness, Jimmy. Thank you for that. Okay.
Well, you and I are often on the same page, John.
So Yeah, I mean, what citizenship taxation does is gives the United States an extra bit of leverage and control over other countries, right? And of course, you know, the whole FACA thing has exacerbated this on steroids.
Well, I would even go just to kind of give listeners maybe a little bit of an idea about this. Because of FACA, if I, as a German citizen, not an American citizen, walk into a German bank and want to open up a bank account in my home country, my country of citizenship, I still have to fill out a W-8-B-E-N to certify to the bank that I'm not a U.S. person. And under the FACA agreements, under the IGA, if the U.S. government asks to see these W-8-B-E-N-Es, the bank has to provide it. So, I mean, just think about how much information that FACA has given them under the guise of, you know, getting information about Americans. They're also able to get a lot of information about a lot of other people.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And since you raised the issue of bank account openings, I'm going to run another thing by you, and I'd be interested to get your thoughts on this. So, you know, as you may or may not know, you know, I've been part of a lawsuit in Canada, right, against FACA. So I spent a lot of time thinking about this stuff. And if you look at the IGAs, you know, they're basically put together to, it's sort of a search and seizure, right? First a search for any U.S.-ness and then a seizure of the information. But as I analyze this, and I ask myself, how does it relate to the Internal Revenue Code, right? So the way the Internal Revenue Code actually works, Section 1 says everybody on the planet is subject to U.S. worldwide taxation. Section 2 provides a couple exceptions, you know, one being non-resident aliens. So it seems to me that in order to maintain consistency with the way the Internal Revenue Code actually works, the IGAs should not be hunting for U.S. citizens. They should be requiring every individual on the planet to do a certification.
Except
of non-U.S. citizenship.
Yep. Yep.
Just imagine that.
Yep.
But this, I mean, you're absolutely correct that U.S. citizenship, it's not as valuable as having the U.S. dollar, the dominant reserve currency. It certainly is not as valuable because I don't think that provides the information extraction facility.
Yeah.
But citizenship taxation does.
For sure.
And, you know, I think that these people, these governments in other countries, they're either willfully blind or they're incredibly stupid, or a combination, because they've really got to wake up to this fact. But the only way around this, interestingly, would be to apply to become U.S. colonies. So, for example, you know, there's all this discussion in the Netherlands about, you know, the people there have been particularly aggressive on the FACA issue. But what if the problem was solved in this way, right? Say, rather than have all this discontent, why not just let the Netherlands apply to become a U.S. colony so it would no longer be foreign for the purposes of all this information type stuff, right?
Yeah.
Or a territory or something like that. And then what happens is it gets treated like Puerto Rico. So then you see the benefit of it would be that U.S. citizens living in Puerto Rico, in the Netherlands, if it were treated as Puerto Rico, would not be taxable on Netherlands income, right? So, you know, I mean, if you look at this stuff logically, it is extraordinary how this stuff, you know, the cascading effects of all this stuff, right? And all of this, you know, is because of this information grab. It is not because of taxation. So when you pair U.S. tax residency.
I'm going to add the information, but I'm going to add though that the information grab ultimately is about taxation.
Yeah. Okay. In the sense of, you know, the what's a 5471 now? Probably 20 pages at least.
Yeah.
You know, where in the sense that what you're doing is you're recording information, you know, for future, you know, what really is confiscation. If you look at something like the transition tax, right? I mean, all those people said, we have these retained earnings. And
well, and that's what I'm getting to. It's the previous lesson of surveilling it so it can be taxed, right? I mean, the government only knew how much they were going to get from this transition tax. And they only invented this transition tax because they had the data from this, from all these 5471s and everything that all these companies have to file.
That's exactly right. I mean, they never could have followed through with any semblance of enforcement without it. So, you know, whenever your accountant says to you, oh, don't worry, it's just an information return. There is no tax.
Worry.
I'm not sure exactly what your response should be in language, but I think you should not believe that it's insignificant. We'll put it that way. Agreed?
Yeah, exactly.
And then, of course, you know, we have the whole penalty thing as well. So, I mean, if you look at, and to be clear, I mean, it's fascinating how I'm not sure. I think this is dead, but I'm not entirely sure because these things can always be resurrected. But this Biden administration suggestion that, you know, any bank accounts with balances of over $600, if you can imagine, all this information goes to the IRS. I mean, it's absolutely insane. You know, clear violation of this principle. So my question now to you is this. Are we the only two people in the world who see it this way?
You know, I think that there, you and I might be the two most vocal people that see it this way. No, you know, I think it's quite interesting. I think a lot of people don't quite give it as much thought as we do, which is a mistake. But I think a lot of people feel just very helpless and hopeless, and they get pissed off talking about it. And so they don't want to. I mean, I know a lot of my clients, a lot of, you know, people that I socialize with, this type of stuff is very much at the top of their discussion topics. But these are also people that are in constant search of liberty, right? I mean, these are people that mostly have left their homeland. I mean, mostly not Americans, but people that have all left their homelands and have been out of their homelands in different places for many years, have structured their assets into different types of vehicles to try to protect it from overreaching governments, and are always looking for the next place where liberty is going to be available. And it's really interesting to me, especially living here in Dubai, with my social group. I mean, there's a large group of people here, and it's interesting how like-minded that they are, that they all came in here in search of liberty, right? In freedom of liberty and financial, and to protect their financial assets. And a lot of these people have moved here from places like Monaco, from, you know, Switzerland, from UK non-dom, from other tax advantage places. But, you know, they always have their eye open for what's developing, because you have to stay one step ahead, right? If you want to maintain.
So back to your question about, you know, where would you look to in the world? You know, we talked about less developed countries. Would a second principle be to look at their tax system and how intrusive are they, and are there how many information returns? I would think that would be an issue, wouldn't you?
I think that is absolutely an issue. And I think the other thing that people have to do is, for people who are truly interested in liberty, they have to realize it's a lifelong quest, right? You can never be complacent, because as countries become more successful and more wealthy, the first thing they start doing is raising taxes and raising their information gathering apparatus. and making things, you know, more regulation. And so if you want to have a true life of liberty, got to be on the move throughout life. And you have to constantly be fighting for it and looking for it.
I think that's right. I mean, you may remember, you know, one of Ronald Reagan's early speeches where he said, freedom is just one generation away from extinction. I mean, maybe today he would say freedom is just one F-bar away from extinction.
Well, I mean, listen, I think he would probably say that freedom might be extinct from quite a few places that claim to have it.
And a third thing, right? So we say, all right, I mean, this is an interesting discussion, okay? So the principles, right? Less developed countries, probably countries that don't have really well-developed tax systems and where the focus is on generating tax revenue and not information returns. Tax treaties, good or bad?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think tax treaties, I think it depends on where your income's coming from, right? I mean, I think tax treaties can be a very important thing if you are trying to attract residents and businesses with international holdings and income in different countries. I think they become very important because sometimes it can become prohibitively expensive to get your assets out of it. You know, the way I look at a lot of this, right, a lot of these people that are in search of liberty, right, they come from first world democracies. They've built up some level of success, and then they've realized that it's just unsustainable for them to achieve their goals by staying where they are. And so they go in search of freedom. But a lot of them still have assets and income generating businesses in these first world countries.
Yeah.
And you need to be able to extract that money. And with the absence of tax treaties, that can become a very expensive endeavor.
That is true. That is absolutely true. Well, you know, although not intended for this purpose, I would really have to think that anybody who's been listening to this discussion today would see the value of getting very, very competent counseling
in
the area before they make these moves.
A lot to consider.
Yeah. And we started this off with, you know, all this, you know, extraction of information stuff. And, you know, and it's interesting because that's basically why people are, at least in my world, that's primarily why people are renouncing U.S. citizenship. I mean, they're just collapsing under the weight of it all.
100%. And I mean, look, most of the people that are renouncing citizenship, you know, they're not even going to save tax dollars, right? The only thing that they're really saving is that they're getting themselves out of the potential penalty box.
Well, and the time,
the compliance cost,
you know, the expense of trying to get, you know, if they can even find competent advisors, you know, in this area. I mean, that's the problem. I mean, you know, we started talking about the whole FBAR thing. I mean, any moron can understand a basic bank account, but many people's lives are not that simple, right?
No, they're absolutely not.
Yeah, that's the problem.
Yep.
So where do you think all this goes? I mean, you know, Charles Adams, of course, you know, sees the rise and fall of civilizations largely driven by tax policy. So where are we going?
Look, I think if you look at the history of taxation, I mean, even go back to the Roman Empire, right? I mean, people were fleeing to the barbarians in Northern Europe because of, you know, to save on taxes. And I think that what we're really starting to see now is the same thing here. I mean, any place that offers tax advantage residency is booming right now. I mean, people are leaving these first world high tax democracies for places all over the world that offer tax advantage living. And I think we're going to continue to see that.
So what are these first world? Let's forget the United States for a minute, okay? And let's look at, you know, the UK, Canada, very high tax countries. Canada has departure taxes. Interestingly, the UK does not.
I think, well, they don't, but they do. What the UK does do is they make it very difficult for you to sever UK domicile status.
Yeah, same thing, Canada, yeah.
Or so for inheritance tax purposes, you might be able to get out for income tax purposes, but for estate tax purposes, you're still in, which is a fairly difficult thing to sever. But look, I think you can basically include most of the EU, Australia, New Zealand, I think those are the mainly the first world democracies that you can look at and say, you know, these are really high tax countries with unreasonable tax regimes.
So what's your definition of wealth in the 21st century?
Look, I've always had the same definition of wealth, and that is freedom. And to me, the only thing actual money buys you is more options and more ability to access personal freedom. And so to me, I think the two go hand in hand, but I don't think it's so much about how much wealth you have. I think it's about how much control you have over your wealth too, how secure your wealth is, and how free you are personally.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting definition. You know, mine would be the ability to live very happily on small amounts of money.
Yep.
You know, because then you don't need to worry about all this stuff. God, life. I mean, well, maybe somebody would say, I mean, if you were living in some third world country listening to the two of us talk, they say, what are these morons talking? I mean, these are first world problems. I mean, they don't know anything about the lives that we have.
You know,
I think there's some truth to that.
There is some truth to that, but I would also say that I also know plenty of Americans that went to America from a third world country, and Canada for that matter too, built up a nice amount of wealth and said, this is unbearable, I'm leaving.
Exactly. Collapsing under the weight of their own, maybe that's it. In the 21st century, many people are collapsing under the regulatory weight of their wealth.
Yeah. No, I mean, look, I think if you look at the compliance costs and everything that goes into running a family office or a structure to hold wealth, I mean, the costs of probably three times what they were 10 years ago, if not more, in order to be able to comply with all this stuff that used to not exist, just to comply with regulation and information reporting and compliance and all this nonsense. And you know, what I always laugh about with all this stuff, right, is I think that in a lot of ways, all of this stuff has just been implemented to also create a barrier from people doing this, right? I mean, if you think about it, you know, before, I mean, I remember when people that have $5 million used to come to me and were like, okay, let's set up some kind of a structure. And now I can't help that.
Money to set up anything.
Not enough money anymore. Yeah. I mean, I would even argue that even at $10 million, right? I mean,
yeah, you say because of the regulatory cost of that.
But yeah, the annual compliance cost, the regulatory cost, it's just the structures, the income that's in there is not going to generate enough money to cover. I agree
with you totally. Let me give you a more pedestrian example. This is just my personal opinion, which means, well, it's just my personal opinion, but you know, in the world of the digital nomad, right, there's all this discussion about, all right, you know, so you leave the United States and your income is no longer sourced to the United States if it's done outside the United States, but you're still subject to self-employment taxes. So what you do is you set up what becomes a CFC, you know, this is the sort of the standard recipe. And, you know, I've increasingly come to see that as not clear. I think it's very contextual and often a very bad idea because, you know, the administrative costs of running the stuff are high and maybe you're better off paying the self-employment tax and building up the Social Security, right?
Well, and I'll even go one step further, which is, you know, this is sort of, as you say, the standard solution. Interestingly enough, Virginia's come across an article that analyzes a subpart F regulations. And I don't remember what the details of it is exactly, but it basically says, if the services of the CFC are performed by a related person, then the income from the CFC is considered subpart F income. And I don't remember exactly the technicalities of it, but basically what it came down to was, if you're the owner officer of this thing, providing all the services, and it's your work that's generating all the revenue, it's basically subpart F income, and you got to pay taxes on it anyway.
Yeah, which means it's going to be a flow through. Well, depending on the tax rate in the
country.
Anybody listening to this, okay, you can already see us ready to start talking technicalities, which means costs and uncertainty, right?
Yeah, amen.
You know, that's the thing. I mean, this whole subpart F regime, as I am convinced, is the most complicated area of the Internal Revenue Code. And interestingly, it's the first thing that the digital nomads who follow the standard recipe run into. Anyway, interesting discussion as always. And what's it all rooted in? It's all rooted in information reporting, you know, et cetera. I mean, I don't think we've even talked about any payment of taxes today, have we?
No.
Amazing stuff. All right. Well, bringing it to an end for today. Great discussion. And I will ask you again, if they can't wait till next Monday to get more Jimmy Sexton wisdom, how would they get a hold of you this week?
Visit us on the web at EsquireGroup.com or shoot us an email at info@EsquireGroup.com.
All right, excellent. And I'm at citizenshipsolutions.ca. Great discussion.